Well, hello everyone, and welcome to another one of these conversations. I'm joined once again. I'm going to try to say your name this time, okay?
Sure.
Charles Adair. How's that?
Yes, Charles Adair. That's good.
Is that all right? Okay. So this is Charles Adair, and if you've seen some of our previous conversations, he's a very interesting chap. Before we get going, where can people find you?
Sure. On Twitter, YouTube, everywhere I am. If you type just the name of my handle, it'll come up. I have a website as well. And I have a book called The Flame of Love. I teach poetry from this book and many other works of Persian literature, Rumi, Hafez, Saadi, all the greats, on Persian Poetics. It's a course platform. And that one is also all over social media. It has, you know, I make short form content basically to promote the work.
Fantastic. And as people know, I also sell courses here on the academic agency, Buy It Now, Trivium, the bestseller, many other great courses available. Now, when I suggested topics to you, obviously we had to talk about Iran, and we did that, and we talked about Persian poetry, but one of the ones that made me raise an eyebrow is that you wanted to talk about the state of the West and what you call Anglo-noticing. Now, in the part of the internet I'm from, noticing means something quite different. So, why don't you explain what Anglo-noticing is?
Well, it's a very particular use of the word, because in the part of the internet you're from, noticing means to notice a particular culture's influence or et cetera. Mm-hmm. Well, I feel like the same thing can be true for Anglos, that we live in an anglicized world. The language of the internet and probably of space colonization, if it ever pans out, and the world and what we know to be culture is in English effectively now, and global notions we talked about in an earlier video together about how democracy, even though it doesn't really mean anything to us, is seen as the default good way to govern Iran. It's another Anglo notion, you know, going back to the American Revolution, maybe. Again, they're looking to Anglo civilization and society. Just so much of the world we live in, the fact that the suit is the default method of dressing and looking like a good person. I started to realize these things as a teenager living in Iran, and I was trying to engage more with the kind of the authentic Iranian or local Iranian culture. My family would say, you know, don't do that, wear a suit, don't do this, have this haircut, or don't talk about this thing, or, you know, be interested in Shakespeare instead of Hafez. And I realized, wow, you know, we're really living in an Anglo world, even all the way over here in Tehran, a place where supposedly, you know, we're very Eastern and we're anti-Western. And then in America, I came back and I noticed many of my immigrant peers, they would always talk about how white people don't have a culture, and how, oh, you know, white, if it does have a culture, it's not a real culture. And we have chicken and rice. And, you know, these discourses, you probably have more of them in the UK than in America. And I start to tell them things like, no, actually, we are very Western culturally, and they do have a great culture. I mean, our notions of justice and freedom and democracy, now, these ideas might be in decline, but they come from this Anglo culture, our sense of civility, how we interact, free speech, all of these things that we do and engage with. I mean, even foods like, you know, fried chicken and mac and cheese, all these foods that we think of just like slop American food, they're actually degraded versions of like high European cuisine. And so, in the same way that noticers will say, you know, if you look around, you'll notice this name and early life and that thing, I'm like an Anglo noticer. I look around to see where's the pervasive Anglo influence now. You know, like you go here in Iran and they're talking about these political ideologies. Oh, that's an Anglo idea. You go to India and you see they have a parliament. Oh, look, there's the Anglo's influence. And we don't know it, but, you know, a lot of the countries in the world, a lot of the economic might, a lot of the armies, a lot of what we know of as the world is English. You know, the Anglos, there's like hundreds of millions of Anglos or anglicized people on the world. There's like a dozen countries where the people are English speaking, they're English oriented, English assimilated. It really is one of the world's great cultures. And when I start to do research, and first through the lens of Iranian Orientalism, reading what English people wrote about Iran, I noticed how things are not like they used to be. And I'm not trying to make value judgments about other cultures, but how the diction of the language has changed, and how the refinement and the fashion. And when you start to kind of Anglo notice, you also can't help but realize that there has been a decline in what we call English culture or Anglo-American culture, that it is even going away. You know, like we talk about the WASPs of America in the 19th, 20th, 18th, whatever century. Where are these people? Have they just given up control of society? They're not at the helm anymore. They've just let society go and let big business interests or whatever run everything. You go to England, you go to London, I didn't really see the England that I'd seen in photos and videos of the past. I mean, not to say that the new people there are not English, because I'm an immigrant product myself, as are you, but it's just different. Whatever exists then is not what existed in the past. So I'm just very interested in tweeting nowadays more about Iran, but I used to be a few weeks ago tweeting a lot about, oh, the English do this, Anglo that. Anyway.
Yeah, I mean, you'd be surprised the number of people who watch my videos who think that this shelf behind me is a backdrop, right? These are real books, right? Real books, yeah. Actual physical books. And these ones on this shelf here are all about the British Empire, or the various different travelers' books of things that the British, like countries they went around. Some might argue countries that they messed up. But one of the things that really interests me, one of the reasons I own these books, is these moments of encounter between European travelers, in this case British travelers in particular, the moment of first contact, when you've had two peoples that had no previous experience of each other. You know, what do they make of each other? And you know, especially in some of the journeys they go to in Africa, there's this one, you know, the source of the Nile, some of the encounters and some of the weird things that happen there. Mm-hmm. I don't believe they made them up. I believe a lot of these things in these books, these days people would be sensitive and they wouldn't want to offend people and so on.
Right.
But I'm looking at it thinking, yeah, that must have been really weird to see, mm-hmm. you know, you meet this chieftain and he's serving you human meat and things like this. It's like,
yeah.
It's, but I mean, I would suggest that the reason that the world, the modern world that we think of, is so anglicized is a remnant of the British Empire. And true, yeah. The reason that you think of it, or we think of it, as being in decline, I mean, my view straightforwardly is that it has been Americanized. I mean, I have a view of America. You know, I'm into some traditionalist writers like Julius Evola and René Guénon and people like that. Well, they have this view of America as being almost an anti-culture, an anti-tradition, and an anti-culture. So many of the things that we think of as being right and proper and the default, good manners, you know, high trust society, I guess you'd call it, high trust society, holding people to good standards, and even down to like minute details. Now, if you came and lived in this country, there's still enough of it alive that you'd notice it. Okay.
Interesting.
Things like in this country, you know, you thank the bus driver as if he's done a favor for you. Okay.
Interesting.
And the reason that you do that is because you don't want to draw attention to the fact that there's been a monetary transaction, because that is the money aspect is seen as grubby and low, right? Whereas the good thing is the high trust and the honor and the sense of kind of, you know, so you kind of cover up the fact that there's been a financial transaction by just, you know, thanking the bus driver as if he's done you a favor. Now, you won't find this in, you know, Brixton or somewhere like that, because the people aren't British, but elsewhere in the country, some of these little customs, you know, they carry on. They carry on. So what I think has happened is that, you know, that there was this book years ago. I had a Bronze Age pervert on. You know, I'm not good mates with him now because of things we've discovered about him. But he talked about this book called The Crisis, The Ordeal of Civility.
Right? I've heard about this book. It's about Jews in Eastern Europe or something.
Well, it's about what they call the Ellis Island Coalition. So that is, you had this WASP culture that existed in America, remnants of which were British customs, British ways of modes of being that had come over. And obviously they'd been Americanized and so on, but they were still some remnant of this.
Yeah.
The Ellis Islanders, some of whom were Jewish, some of them were Mediterraneans from Italy, some of them were Irish, of course, Catholics. They found it stifling. They found it an ordeal. They found it uptight. So a lot of the what people think of as the 1960s cultural, countercultural revolution and the loosening of this kind of stiff WASP mode is explained in this book, The Ordeal of Civility, as being a kind of, well, this is a kind of way back. You know, they weren't allowed into the country clubs, or if they were, they found it too much to deal with. Mm-hmm. Because there was a degree of formality in the world of British life, had formality. You know, like, I mean, my mother is from a mining town in Wales, okay, a little, and they were coal miners, you know, they were coal miners, but people wore suits. They right. were well, they, even if they were poor, they were well presented. They made sure that, you know, they would make an effort, basically, as a mark of respect, which ran through the entire society. Mm-hmm. And there was a degree of hierarchy as well, where you kind of doffed, you know, one of the things they used to do was doff the cap, you know, for someone who was like, I don't know, the local landlord or something like that. Mm-hmm. All of these sorts of things were resented by the likes of the Ellis Island Coalition. So you could argue that the what people see as Americanization is actually the making looser of these old formal codes, these social codes, and the, you know, I mean, and as a mark of decline, right? I remember about a month ago, I was out shopping in a supermarket, and there was a woman, must have been about 25, walking around the supermarket in her pajamas.
It's very American, very normal in America, by the way.
Right. And I involuntary, because she was with her mother, who was probably closer to being my age or older, I looked at her mother as if to say, are you all right with this? Are you not going to say it? Like, so I kind of gave her, afterwards I was thinking, like, that was me being like the kind of equivalent of the tutting old woman from when I was growing up. But this is the thing that has kind of gone out of the culture, where people used to tell each other off and uphold these codes. Whereas now, of course, nobody wants to be judged. It's too judgy to give somebody a look as if to say, what the hell are you doing wearing pajamas, you know, at 2 o'clock in the afternoon in the supermarket. So this is my analysis of where.
Yeah, it sounds right. One thing that people maybe don't understand is, maybe Americans even more than anyone, is we think of the founding fathers as already being American, because we have this weird American perception of history. You, of course, think of them as being English who broke away, but we think of them as being American. And oftentimes, I remember a linguist said, by the way, they would have had British accents back then. So then they would go back and forth. Ben Franklin would talk about going to London as going home. And they would talk about the Germans immigrating to Pennsylvania, the boorish Palatines, because Germany wasn't even a thing back then, as being a threat to the Anglo provenance of America and all that. So they thought of themselves as very English, and they would go back and forth for the next century, thinking of England as, you know, a cousin country. And famously, Churchill's mother or grandmother was from the Bronx, and many famous Americans were either directly from England or they had maternal ancestry in England. So we were a very English country until maybe, I don't know enough to say, but maybe the Ellis Islanders coming in their millions, which, now we talk about whiteness. Back then, they weren't white. They were seen as, you know, from the slums of Southern Europe, and they're Catholic and Papists. And there's a movie called The Gangs of New York that kind of, it's semi-fictionalized, semi-historical, by an Italian, by the way, so you can tell his perspective, Martin Scorsese, about this kind of, again, this ordeal of bringing Irish and Italians in. But it was Irish back then, the earliest waves. And what's amazing is people don't think about this with enough sobriety, is that the Irish are still not assimilated. They're still very Irish in America. They still have kind of distinct accents and neighborhoods, and they give their kids names like Seamus, and they're very Republican, and they have Irish enclaves. In fact, some of the legally protected homeowners associations that are like ethnic enclaves of the sort that Orthodox Jews and now they white people have in the middle of America, like these white supremacist groups, some of them are Irish in America. Like, we have a place called Breezy Point in Queens, New York, that's like an Irish, effectively ethnic protected enclave, where, like, if you're not Irish, you basically can't go, in effect. So even these people, after being here for nearly 150 years, you know, Italians famously, they had their mafias that we had to, I think I said that in a tweet that went kind of viral, that we had to basically break our own Anglo principles to uproot the mafia. We had to have unconstitutional practices. because the Anglo system wasn't used to clannishness, wasn't used to people committing crimes as a clan as opposed to as individuals. We had to break with this notion of charging individuals, and we had RICO laws where we charge whole groups of people at once, like a, you know, a trial with 100 members as defendants. So when every group comes, they bring a new cultural affectation. And what we know of as America today is really Ellis Island. It's not that old America. The majority ethnic origins in America are German and Irish and Italian. They're not English. Americans are people who just would once call themselves Americans, right? Really, whatever white person you see in America who scratch the surface, they're really like a German, right? They're Schumacher or Schmidt or something like that. So America with every wave just becomes a new thing. Now, what I would argue against some people on the right is that even that wave was still interesting. You know, the you have the Sopranos and the Godfather and the pizza and the spaghetti and Little Italy. There's still something beautiful about it, even if it brought growing pains. What I worry now in our modern immigration culture, our modern world, is that it's just all sloppified, that the new immigrants will not bring Godfathers and Sopranos and Little Italy's. They'll just bring like chicken chops and, you know, cringe mosques. You know, think of what the Italians brought. Papism was foreign to us, you know, Anglo-Protestant Americans. Catholicism was foreign. But no one can say that the Basilica on Fifth Avenue and 55th Street is anything but a marvelous, beautiful representation of like Greco-Roman Mediterranean culture. That's a beautiful addition to our Americana. But I'll speak for myself, the ugly mosques that immigrant groups build today, none of them have any architectural merit as far as I'm concerned, are not a beautiful addition to the American landscape. They're just this weird botched product of modernity. So there's this quote that assimilation is always happening. It's just a matter of who's assimilating into what, right? So we were able to, with projecting force, with having a confident culture, turn Italian Americans with all their difficulties as a beautiful part of the American landscape. I just wonder if the new groups that will immigrate will be that, or will they be like Brazil? Will we have like compounds and all these immigrant groups run around in this dysfunctional society and the existing elite just kind of wall themselves off? I don't know. That's kind of my worry. And again, from just the perspective of wanting the best for America, not having any like racial allegiance, because here I am, you know, a brown guy with my hat on.
Yeah, I mean, I make a couple of observations here. The first thing is that, I mean, in this country, we've had there's this thing called the Boris wave, which was, you know, record number of immigrants came under Boris Johnson. Frankly, a lot of them are from, you know, they're either Indian or Pakistani. And I mean, they haven't even like built mosques or anything like that. Large majority of them end up working in a vape shop, or working in one of those shops that repairs mobile phones, or working in a petrol station. And when I look at those people, all of whom look thoroughly miserable, by the way, right?
It's unfortunate, honestly. Yeah, it's unfortunate.
I often think, like, is there even anything to assimilate to? We talk about the atomized individual. You know, if you're behind this completely soulless, these places are horrible. Like the modern vape shop or the modern,
right?
It's kind of like the high street equivalent of detritus. Nobody wants it there. You know, like it's kind of that's one of the things. Like even on a human level, I think like not only is this ruining the culture that already exists, it cannot be good for these people themselves. Like they cannot be happy.
Right.
They
don't live happy. Yeah. So that's one thing I think I add to the immigration skeptical debate is that most people are speaking from the perspective of being a white Westerner and they just don't want foreigners there. I come from the complete opposite angle. I am kind of negative about immigration from the perspective of an Easterner, saying that actually Iranians who go to Europe as refugees often do end up depressed and regretful. And there's a whole social media genre of people who make videos talking about how deeply regretful they are, but that they can't go back because they came as refugees and they hate their life in Germany or England. It's cold, it's depressing, it's dark. We need the human capital. So I speak from the perspective of someone who says, actually, this is depressing for the immigrants. My dad was always depressed and still is about not being in Iran. It's terrible for the home country because we lose our needed human capital after investing in these people for so long. And it produces this just weird, sloppified culture. It's not like it used to be. You know, something about the modern world is just broken. The local people don't have the will to create a new assimilated identity. You know, like Italian Americans, if they came today, I wonder if there would be quote unquote Italian Americans. You know, it's a very distinct American creation. Yeah. I wonder if they would just be Italian.
It's the horrible thing of like the kind of random African in the Manchester United top with his mobile phone, or the, I don't know, like in America, it'd be NFL, or it's like this in itself is already an anti-culture. It's already like not like even from the point of view of the native Brits or the native American, like the not Native Americans, you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. The Anglo-Americans, right? It's already an anti-culture. And now you're just adding more. It's just another person in KFC with a mobile phone wearing the sports team of some place he's never even been to. You know what I mean? It's like, there's something I wanted to mention about the Irish and the Italians, though.
Sure.
This is a book called The Dispossessed Majority by Wilmot Robertson. Now, depending on who you speak to, for some people, like he's probably thought of as a white nationalist or racist or something. Mm-hmm. By leftists, but he talks very much about this process that you're talking about, what actually happened to the cultures and the places that were inhabited by the Ellis Island groups. One of the things, and in fact, this is also talked about in a different context by Thomas Carlyle, who they experienced a large wave of Irish immigration in Victorian England, which is where he was writing. One of the things about both of those groups, and of course about Jewish people as well, is that they are organized. Okay, so one of the reasons that the mafia are an issue is because they are an organized minority, separate from the law, separate from the existing structures. They're basically making their own power structure.
Right, it's like a parallel government in a way.
Yeah, the Irish, because partly, I mean, think about this now. You're a Catholic. That means you go to a separate congregation to the Protestants who live in the town. You're meeting in the same building with your fellow ethnics, okay, on a weekly basis. Now, from a purely political point of view, what you're doing there is you're colluding. You're conspiring, because that's all it is. You just need people together in a building, and already that's political power. And what the Irish were very good at doing in America was taking over things like the unions, the police. Firefighter, you know, they operated in that way. But one of the reasons they were able to do it, of course, is because they had that weekly congregation in the Catholic Church. Well, it doesn't take too long. Oh, we'll stay behind after mass or whatever, and then we can discuss how we're going to take the fire service or whatever. And this was not only an issue in America; it remained an issue in this country as well. Like, if you think about the places where socialism is strong, in Glasgow, right? They're Irish. In Liverpool, which where you know the Beatles, right? The Beatles were basically Irish.
Interesting. I didn't know that.
But the reason that Liverpool is a socialist stronghold is because of the Irish roots, and they maintain that kind of you know, they may forget about the fact of the Catholicism and the Irishness and so on, but they maintain the organized element, which is separate and apart. And once you see this, I mean, we talk about noticing, right? Once you see this, you can see how it can persist as a kind of social. I mean, you could say it's a problem. You could say it's a beautiful thing. I see it as an issue because once you weaken the thing that it's all built on, right, it can persist as long as that center is strong enough to be able to tolerate and maintain it. And what I think has happened in America is that it's basically like built up enough momentum that it's completely destroyed what was there before. And I mean, in this country, I think it's been in the process of destroying what was there before. And once that's gone, you can never get it, but like you can never.
Right. You just have to build something from scratch again. You can't get it back.
Right.
That's exactly, true. Yeah. So I view this from the perspective of, again, completely different perspective of other people who are interested in sociology and anthropology. I'm a Muslim. I'm an Easterner. I'm a humanist. I'm interested in high culture and building society. I view this from the perspective of not that I have any particular allegiance. Like, I'm not an Anglo person here to Anglo culture or any other culture. And in fact, I would feel more at home with Italians every day of the year than with Anglos, you know, for sure. But I just view it from the perspective of what is more conducive to a healthy, stable, functioning society, what will produce a high culture, what will lead to human flourishing and human dignity. So from my perspective, maybe there is something essential to people's culture or not, but I just view it as if we had a society that was organized around the existing principles of individualism, of human liberty, of, you know, markets being generally free, of care for the poor, but in a restrained way, of having, you know, a voluntary religious association, like going to Protestant churches every week or going to a mosque, that there would just be more human flourishing, and that the example is in the societies, that countries like England did better than Ireland, and countries like the Netherlands did better than Spain and Portugal, and America did better than Mexico. And it's not for nothing, right? Australia, you shipped off your criminals and they made a first world country. I mean, I hate to say it like that, but it really is what it is. So, and if we in Iran could look over at India's example, that India is dysfunctional in a million ways, but one way it's functional is that they have elections and a parliament that actually works to some degree. And they do have a free system, and that there is generally free speech and civil liberties. You don't have thousands of people massacred in protests in India generally, even with all of its problems, this like kind of English inheritance that it has. So if we look at it from that angle, again, because I am coming from a completely different cultural, social, political, you know, background as you, just from the angle of human flourishing, would we be better off with the clannishness of Sicilians or the individualness of Anglos? Would we be better off with the religious universalism of Protestants or the religious peculiarisms of Jews and Catholics? I just feel like the answer is in the experience that America has done better with these principles. And that, like you said, if that core is lost, we were fine with the immigration because everyone kind of agreed, okay, we'll lose our peculiarities and we'll kind of do it the American way. But I feel like nowadays that's not happening anymore. That even Trump, as the standard bearer of white America, is very much not living up to those Anglo norms. He doesn't disclose his taxes. He doesn't remain married to the same woman for his whole life. He doesn't, you know, restrain himself and speak in a very refined way. He's very garish and ugly for an Anglo, more than maybe an Italian guy even. Right? It's very kind of anti-civil in a way. So I think maybe we've already lost it because the left has no pretense of that in America. It was the country club Republicans, and they voted for Trump. So it might be cooked, honestly.
I mean, my view, which I've come to after many years of studying this stuff and thinking about it and so on, is that this individualism that you talk of doesn't have any antibodies. It doesn't have any defense.
100%.
The person who's tribally minded.
It's fragile.
Right. So, I mean, you know, in elite theory, we say, well, the organized minority defeats the disorganized mass 10 times out of 10. Okay.
Yes.
You have 100 organized men. You will defeat the crowd of 1,000 disorganized men every single time. But if individualism is your ruling doctrine, of course, every other group is going to beat you, is going to win out, is going to beat out. And I think, unfortunately, the Anglos, the white people, the WASPs, and so on, are finding out the limits of this as a way. The other thing I'd say is that, you know, we started out talking about the British Empire and about, you know, you're saying, well, this way has won out. I often wonder about whether, in a way, people are getting cause and effect mixed up.
Interesting.
Look, the British Empire, was it really individualistic? Was it really free markets? Actually, this was a post hoc justification for what the British Empire wanted to do. Okay. Let's take something like laissez-faire free markets. Okay. You say, well, the best way to organize things is free markets under the division of labor. Okay. Competitive advantage, David Ricardo. What that actually meant in practice was the British Empire saying to a place like Ghana, you're going to grow chocolate. We're going to take that chocolate and turn it into chocolate bars and sell it back to you. Okay. That is actually what was happening. And it was just called free markets. And this was the justification given. And then as soon as that was So when you start thinking about free market doctrine as a ruling ideology to justify what it was that the empire was doing at any given moment, and then remember, as soon as it wasn't advantageous anymore, they dropped it. So by 1890, 1900, it's tariffs again. And you can see the American empire doing the same thing. Because when you're the hegemon, when you're the number one, it behooves you, it is advantageous to draw people into your sphere of influence to say, well, you know, you don't have a choice. You have to trade with us, right? It's like everybody wants to be part of this club. But when it's going down, you've lost, like, it's no longer, and this every empire basically goes through this kind of rising and falling. Whereas, I mean, even Genghis Khan, right?
Mm-hmm.
Even Genghis Khan became a free marketeer once he conquered all the territories.
Yeah.
Sounds ridiculous, but commerce did flourish under the Mongols.
Yeah, Pax Mongolica, as they say.
Right? So yeah. once you see it in these terms, and you know, there's a book called The Ethnic Phenomenon, by a guy called Pierre Vandenberg, who really breaks this down in a way that I'd never, and you know, I used to be a proper libertarian, like Mises Institute. I wrote a whole book called The Defenders of Liberty. But now I've come to see actually like the justifications come after the fact.
I believe that. Yeah, that makes sense. Right?
And then the other thing is that if you think about the British system, the free market system, the economics and liberalism and all the rest of it, it was always leeching off the codes and custom that had built up over hundreds of years of feudalism and aristocracy and that kind of hierarchical culture. This is discussed actually by, what's his name? Joseph Schumpeter, who says, like, look, the British would never have been able to pull off what they did had they not had hundreds of years of that built-in respect for hierarchy, rules, and things like this. It didn't come from nowhere.
You need that orderliness to run a quarter of the world.
Right, and this is why you can't just say, well, I mean, look at the experiments, like Liberia, right?
Right.
Liberia was meant to be this great experiment. You can't do it with Liberians.
Right.
Why can't you do it with Liberians? Because I'm not trying to be racist here or something, but you in this country, you sign a contract, you make a deal to do something, it better bloody be done. Otherwise, there's going to be consequences, okay? So everybody operates under the assumption that when you sign a contract, the job will be done. In Africa, I mean, you can watch Empire of Dust, right? You sign a contract with the guys to pick up...
It doesn't mean anything.
Right? You're going to pick up these pipes on Monday. Come Monday, nobody's there.
Pipes, right, you know, exactly.
2 weeks later, the pipes are still there. But what the hell's going on? Right? I mean,
I use this as an example to tell someone why copy-pasting the American Constitution won't work to make Iran a first-world country, because he said that's what we should do. Reza Shah will come copy-paste it. I said, well, they tried that in Liberia, and it didn't work because you missed the causation. The Constitution expresses what was already known subtly. It was just verbalizing it so that everyone was on the same page. So you can't just copy-paste the Constitution, because Liberians don't think that way. They have their own culture, their own way of understanding, being, experiences, history, environment, all these things affect things. But anyway, go ahead. Yeah.
Well, I mean, but there's a certain amount that just can't be taught, right? I'll give you my example, my experience of being in Iran, right? Every single time I got into a car, I thought I was going to die.
Yeah.
Okay. It could be my uncle or somebody I knew, even like a family member, right? We'd be driving. Let's say there's a turn coming up. They were going 70 miles an hour, and they took the turn as if they were in an action movie.
Right.
Like, they literally took it at 70 miles an hour. I was like, holy shit! Like no pause, no indication.
Yeah.
Every single I don't know. There's four lanes. Somebody over here has got the bright idea. They want to be over there, and somebody just, over here.
Yeah.
It's just absolute chaos.
Yeah. We have one of the highest death rates on the road in the world, by the way. Look it up.
Highest outside
of Africa.
In this country, right, people just follow the people. I say people, British people, not some of the new arrivals. And the closer you get to London, the less this is true. But in most of the country, people just follow the rules. Right, if there's a red light, it means you stop. if there's a, and I don't know how you teach that. If you, how do you pick that up and teach it to another culture? It seems to me like I used to say this thing, communication is, civilization is incommunicable.
Yes, that's very like, true. I agree with
you
that.
You know, or I mean, something else on a plane, right? Or on a, anywhere in this country, people will naturally form a queue. Orderly form a queue. Okay. And this, I'm not making this up. This is what British people are like. Germans also can do this. Again, you try doing that on a flight to in the mid, going somewhere in the Middle East, or half the people.
Or even Italy. Italy. I was in the airport in Luton, and there was a flight going to somewhere else in England, and it had an orderly queue. And then right next to it, there was the flight to Naples, and it was just like Iran. And when I went to Naples, I was in utter shock because I thought, oh, I'm in Europe. But when you look around in Naples, it's the Middle East. It's just like Cairo. It's just like Tehran. Same look, same vibe. Everyone interacts the same almost. And you think, wow, you know, even within continental Europe, in Rome, effectively, it's, you know, it's so, it's just unassimilably different. These people could not all go to England and just all behave like English people and vice versa. It just wouldn't work.
So I don't know, like, I, so like coming to these conclusions, they're not the conclusions you want to have as someone who's like been brought up in a liberal kind of, you know, with all our high ideals and so on, but you have to conclude at some point that people are different, like the people of the world are different, and it's gonna be like you cannot make them into each other. They're gonna you know, you pick up those people from Rome and plonk them somewhere else, they're just gonna make Italy, or they're just gonna make like a little Tehran, or a little, you know, in enough bulk. So this has been my, you know.
No, you're right. And I think it's even a beautiful thing because, you know, it says in the Quran, we have made you in tribes and languages so you'll know each other. I want there to be Naples and London and Tehran. It's good that we're not all just tabula rasa, blank slate. You know, you just drop someone off and they wake up and they're just the same person. I'm actually happy that despite how assimilated I am, I have a Persian heart, that when I read the poetry, I feel like my ancestors did. I wouldn't want to be a fully anglicized person. I like that, my apologies, I showed up 5 or 10 minutes late, or that I have this Persian affectations. That's beautiful. And again, going back to what I said earlier, I am not white, I'm not Western, I'm not any of these things. I'm not a political person. So I'm not looking at this issue from those perspectives. My perspective is, how can we maximize human flourishing? How can places keep their people and actually improve instead of just shipping off their poor masses to other places? So that's the lens that I look at these things. Like, I would love to go to Naples and just be surrounded by Neapolitans. I don't want to live in a world where Neapolitans think, oh, I make €6 an hour here and I can make 10 quid an hour in London, so let's just all go to London now. And then London is just like, no one knows what the hell is going on. And if it's in, you know, not PC to say that, that's fine. I don't know. I just, the way that the modern world is being created by the people in charge, I don't see them creating anything beautiful. They are not creating civilization. They're creating this weird, everyone's a little economic unit and just get dropped off to wherever you're needed most. No one lives anywhere for many generations. Everyone just moves places. It's just, I don't know. It's sad. I hate to see, like, to see people who've lived for places for generations, they just get up, oh, I have a job offer in California, I'm moving there, and they just separate from their family. Yeah. It's a very lame, kind of socially destructive way of organizing things we have.
Yeah, Carl, I'll call this nomadism, right? But I mean, my conclusion after years of looking at this is that, you know, some things have to be held artificially constant. You know, like the EU has these things, the four freedoms, like freedom of capital, freedom of move people, freedom of services, and freedom of something else. I think at least two of the four, freedom of goods is the other one, have to be kept constant. Otherwise, you don't have a culture. There has to be some artificial constraint to say, look, here, the way things are, you're not allowed to do this, that, that, and the other. And we are just going to use the government to safeguard that thing there. And otherwise, as this system that you're talking about ends up sweeping everything else away, and then your culture ends up turning into the Disneyland version of itself.
Right.
Yeah, and this is the thing I wonder, I worry about with Iran. You know, all these people like Mayor Tuzi and so on. Oh, wouldn't it be wonderful? Like, well, what happens when they all get into Isfahan and then turn it into the Disneyland version of it?
Or, which is like, what European capitals are known for being, unfortunately.
Yeah, you'd be like a kind of living museum, or you know,
Paris, Vienna. They're living museums, open air museums, as they're called.
Like being Mexicans, a taco, you know, a little wearing a silly little hat and eating tacos or something. This is like, this I think is a problem that faces the entire world.
Yes, and you're 100% right.
Every culture needs a kind of response. You know, I often look at the Japanese as people who may have found like a decent halfway, like they don't reject modernity, but they maintain enough for themselves that it's obvious that you're in Japan. If you've ever been, you know, it's
you're right.
Like,
yeah.
They maintain enough of themselves that they don't get fully kind of Americanized. And this I think is the, you know, if you want to talk about a human project, this is what I mean. I would like to see not just you do, like you're doing this stuff and you try to keep like your Iranian-ness alive and so on, but in a way, like more like British people need to start doing this. Or
yeah, I agree.
Irish need to start doing this. You know what I mean?
I agree completely. No, I agree. Everyone needs to have civilizational self-confidence. Everyone should feel comfortable, especially in their own country. To assert themselves and say, look, I belong to this place. This is my land. This is my culture. These are my poets. This is my history. These are my heritage. And it doesn't matter what happened 100 or 200 years ago, if there was an empire or not, if there were abuses or not. It's part of the human heritage. I would be sad if there weren't people like you who love Shakespeare and there weren't people who are preserving English heritage and architecture. There's a reason the world is fascinated and there's like an overwhelming amount of tourists in London because there's something there. There's something interesting to see. And Iran, in many ways, a weird byproduct of its isolation in the last 5 decades is that it does not have that slopified modern culture as endemic. It's there, the pizza and the rap music and whatever, but Iran is still Iran. When you go to Iran, you know you're in Iran. It's like being in Japan. You know you're in Japan. The Gulf is not like that. When you go to the Persian Gulf countries and you go to Dubai, I mean, you see there's like a desert around you. Sure, you see dudes in white robes, but you're just in Las Vegas in the desert. Well, that's also in the desert. So you're just in Las Vegas, but with no casinos, right?
Yeah.
And many other places in the world are like that.
Well, it's been another fascinating conversation. Thank you so much for your time. Where can people find you?
Likewise. Yeah, sure. Shahrzadeh on YouTube. I've just kind of started uploading on YouTube more frequently and Instagram, and I have a website under that name. Persian Poetics is where my poetry, linguistics content, classes go. So we are reading poetry, but it's an artifact of Iranian civilization. And we do end up getting into these civilizational discourses, culture, migration. We talk about how Iran colonized and Persianized places. So these discourses are pertinent to our classes. And we have a great group of people who are like yourself, perspective thinkers and perceptive thinkers. And they have insights and interests in a broad range of things. So I was glad. Thank you for having me for these conversations as well. It reminds me of our classes.
Yeah, I should try. I mean, you're probably used to this, but if you spend any time with my dad, literally every single thing ever in the history of the world was invented by Iran. I know it's a stereotype, but it's kind of like he will find a way to tie everything back. So that is something.
At least we care about civilization. That's good. We care about invention and civilization.
And I will just remind people, pick up a course at the Academic Agency. Trivium, bestseller there. Shakespeare also available. Many other great courses. But most importantly of all, get out. And it's going to kick us out. So this will be goodbye. Properly goodbye. All right. Bye-bye. If you like this video, be sure to like and subscribe. You can join the channel for thousands of hours of past shows in the archive and hundreds of videos. If you have any questions, you can leave a super chat or a super thanks, and I'll be sure to pick it up during my weekly office hours, which run every Tuesday afternoon. I also provide courses at the Academic Agency, which I encourage people to buy. Thousands of students now have taken the Trivium to improve their skills in writing, Logic, and Rhetoric. Just three of many courses available. Buy it now. But most importantly of all, friends, get out.